is directly next to that, and the time is 8:03 a.m. that he gave his committee room in the Alaska State Capitol to meet with Trudeau. Members of Health Education present are representing Andy Stewart, co-chair, Representative Mike Brock, Representative Ron Dell, Representative Mike Brock is with us on Teams, Representative Tiffany Zimkowski, and myself, co-chair, Representative Gloria Drummond. We have a lot to conduct business before we begin. I'd like to remind everyone to silence their cell phones. Today, our remote recording secretary is Lori Wong, and Alex Jules Schillinger, moderator in the room, assisting with technical and marketing support. Thank you both for making this meeting possible. Today, we have a presentation on demonstrating teaching and reading through culture by Tony Lazzi, who is the project coordinator at Tribal Liaison in the Department of Education and Early Development. Good morning, Mr. Eisenberg. Can you hear me?
So these are the components that I'm going to be demonstrating. I'm going to be demonstrating the query from a kind of crank height, so a pretty text-based comprehension or crank letter teaching to about third or three. And it's going to progress very quickly through that. So I just wanted to point that out, that I wouldn't necessarily do everything I'm doing today with a kindergartner. It's going to be working through very quickly so that the committee has like, a snapshot of what those grades might look like. And so I provide the rubric just to be able to kind of track around, track along with similar terms they might hear in science or writing presentations or evidence-based practices. So that's what this rubric sheet is for, just to be able to get back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a quick request. For the classroom building school boards have been doing a rubric for many years. If you could explain that briefly, what a rubric is for the benefit of everyone who is watching and listening.
Thank you. Thank you. The rubric is in this case, there are six topics, and it allows for evaluating or tracking what is being presented to see in evaluation tool kind of format or an assessment tool kind of format if those topics have been touched on and what kind of comments the person who's experiencing it might have. And that's kind of how I do the rubric in this format, this kind of almost like a grade tool or an evaluating tool.
Great, thank you.
Great. So we're going to dive right into the demonstration part of it. And we'll go to slide three, and tell me how is it mesh. So this is one of the pieces that we start announcing off with when working with youth. It is the student song, and it's a way of showing the children, the students, that the adults are here to work with them in care. So I'm going to start off by singing the song. This is a way of welcoming students into the educational space, and it's demonstrating through students listening that they get to hear language, but they also get to hear the intent of the teacher and the instructor and the staff that they care about the students. It's a wonderful thing to welcome them into the space, welcome them into the world, and hope that they do well in life. And that's a way of saying that they're calming down the room. So the students don't have to start out with answering questions when they can come into the space. The teacher then is acknowledging them into that space. The song is towards the starting vocals, but those are called vocals, and they don't necessarily have the corresponding direct English translation, but they're part of using the sound as a way of communicating it. The other piece that you might see in the vocal pools is they often have a lot of vowels in them, and it's a really good tool for developing an ear for how the vowels sound. So that's why I started off this piece, is working with a group of pre-grading students. There won't be text, we would just be singing this to them, so they get to hear it, and run in text, and they get to
hear it. I have a question.
Yes.
Everything everywhere you call what does that time mean? he doesn't have a direct translation.
I have a question to the chair. What Bukhari is the word that can mean prayer, it can mean love, it can mean having an intention or awareness of the being that is above and surrounding all of us. Sometimes it's translated as God, sometimes it's translated as love, sometimes it's an awareness of that connection to the world around us. I appreciate the question. The way that I'm trying to present the material here is the color coding word. Tonight is blue, English is purple. And in your bilingual environment, there are some words that may not be translated regularly, like words for thank you that you want the students to say all the time. And so I've been a little bit of that here, and sorry about your curriculum, so I appreciate the question to draw attention to that piece. When there are high frequency words that we don't use the equivalent English of because they're developing a high frequency piece. All right, I appreciate the question to the chair, if we can find the slide four. We're going to continue with, this is another round of slides, they're very short songs. The denominator consonant structure, our alphabet is a very easy alphabet to learn to read. The vowels, there's only four vowel letters, and they experience what we call lowering. And this is where it's a little bit tricky for early So I'm going to go through a couple of the songs, and hopefully you'll start to see the difference between some of the letters that affect the vowels and some don't, and we'll talk through it a little bit. So this first one is a warm-up song. There's E, O, A, A, E, O, A, A, E, O, A, A, E, O, A, A. Without that, we can use the different types of voice of high low, which are actually that's all the robot voice, we do actions with it, it gets moving, that's our vocal cord warm up. The next one is the deep vowel song. It goes oho, 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 echo, 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 echo. And the last one for this page is it's our 4-1-3 song. That goes B, D, O, 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 Deva, Deva, Vila, Deva, Deva, Vila, Deva, Deva, Vila. So you can see on this, the deep vowel song and the 4-1-3 vowel song, they're paired with the double G, which we call the kind of for that. That's pronounced and boom, and then the G is pronounced to boo. So even though there's only one letter for the letter U, it makes three sounds, either O or O, depending on which vowel consonant is before or after it. So this is a way of showing that a consonant vowel relationship lowering. This can be done in flashcards, but we have sounds that help show that to develop some of those literacy tools or skills. So if we go to the next slide, I mentioned that the consonants in Tanaya are very straightforward. They have a nearly one-to-one connection where each consonant makes its own sound. And this sound was developed at the Estimated Wave Mathematization Institute in Fairbanks, Alaska. And we had a group of about 980 first language speakers together. And this is one of the questions the community has had before. Can we do things, can languages work together? And the answer is yes, they can. Up to 40% common, which means we share about 40% of our morphemes or other words. And our alphabets are very similar. So on this page, you see that there are blue letters. And blue letters mean that those are denominator-only letters. And the green letters mean those are object-only letters. All of the black letters represent shared letters between the two languages. So I'm going to send you through that song. This is the warming up for a consonant song. It goes, ho, cho, 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 za, cha, ha, ta, ha, na, na, wa, ya, u, na, za, sa, ha, cha, ta, cha, ta, cha, ta, cha, ta, hui, hui, cha, ta, cha, ta, cha, ta, cha, ta, hui, hui. Okay, sit here with a handful of times. I'm kind of truncating some of the things with you today so I can see them, but we're not here for hours. Not any time intervene tonight. We have a sound drum, so you can hear them clips. There's a dance that goes with your vocal fit. And so that's an example of how our two languages can support each other. And it's not the process. So you might notice that it's not an alphabetical order song. The way that we address alphabetical order is we use the English alphabet song for alphabetical order, and our alphabetical order for second teaching follows that order in English. So we might also adopt from teacher ABCD in that chain. So that helps us with the alphabetical order tool, helps us create that bridge between an indigenous language and English. So this song is really a tool for learning the concepts of the two languages. This tool also has there's some dialect variation in Tobago, where the upper dialect in the Anchorage area, north all the way up to Denali, doesn't use the letter C or CH. They use Y's for that. So even though some of the dialects have different sounds to them or don't include certain sounds, teaching a basic understanding so that any student can read any of the text is part of the goal of teaching literacy for how this is designed to be functioning. In the 1970s, from 1972, there was linguist, interpretary, and cultural anthropologist named Alan Boris, who came to Yale after, and that's when there was a very concerted effort to write down the languages in the orthography that we see today for these two languages. But what Dr. Carey used in Malala.com is the Navajo writing system. The Navajo is an integrated language family. It's about 10% cognitive, meaning 10% of bark, similar words can be understood. Like C for head and hair is the same in both languages. And that was really important in 1973. Our first topical dictionary that we published was in 2007. And Danetta is actively working on a verb sound dictionary. The first anthropological documentation was really done by Cornelius Vosgood in 1910, around that era. And he had a slightly different writing system that was then translated from English into German, which was the academic writing exam at the end of the day. And that's where a lot of historical texts will have to Naino with the T, because that was the second Naino word. Write it down in English and translate that to German, it might prevent that to a tongue. And so the little bit of history of the orthography is about 150 years or 104 years.
Great, thank you very much. Rick Clements, the president of the college.
Hi, Chair. Always great to see you, Mr. Isaac. Thank you for sharing with Mr. Clements this morning on this issue. And I think it's an informal question to the chair's question that was posed. Looking at your teaching, reading through culture, might be permanent. We don't have to refer to it since we're working through this particular document. You indicate that African American Native peoples are predominantly rural societies, and you were speaking a bit with the chair about the orthography and documenting the language. I'm curious if you have a sense or perspective. Even, and we have a great indigenous people in the languages of Alaska in the committee room that highlights the 20 plus indigenous languages that exist in Alaska. We're hearing about one of them today. But do you have a sense of where the rest of the Alaska Native languages in the state are in terms of progress of documenting the language in the same way that we're hearing about this morning?
Representatives of the state, thank you for the question. The tools that I'm presenting today, I know of a handful of indigenous languages that are doing this kind of teaching through song, teaching through tools like having the morphine flashcards that are in the packet. Shingat is doing a similar process, our languages, our language background overall. I think that this, our background is considered a non-native language family, so we have the kind of like distinct cousins. So our languages function in a similar fashion, but they're very different. If you look at more largely the interior of the kind of purple, pink, or red hues, those are the Dene languages, and they're kind of like the outline blues to green. Those are would be Yupik-Nupiak Nandian languages. They function similarly, they are different languages. Again, not the exact same, and not brother or sister, but more like a descended family. So there are, I would say, about half of the languages on that map have some type of scaffolded confrontation that involves song, that involves text-based components, and involves cultural teaching. The level of seamless literacy programs that go from early literacy or play literacy speaking, which is really where literacy starts, with learning through a auditory learning piece. So if you learn to walk before you learn to run, you learn to crawl before you learn to walk, you learn to listen before you learn to speak, you learn to speak before you learn to read, but you have a similar analogy. And so I would say there's about half and half that. I've worked with four closely, if I can include Yupik, Dena'ina, Thinket, and Atma, to really see what they're doing in practice. That's also parts of the presentation today that I'm very much focusing on today languages because I'm most familiar with that. But also that's the realm of the closeness that I've really worked with language families on.
Around culture-based education. Would it be a fair assessment to say that the progress that we're looking for today as it relates to the Dene language is in various forms throughout the state of West and with other Alaska Native languages, and that additional resources could better capture the opportunity to teach culture and place-based education in the classrooms in the state?
Chair represents a custody agreement. Speak to that, and if I don't answer it all the way, please do follow up. So the feedback that I hear from my role in the department is that there were certain types of gatherings and bilingual conferences that were happening back in the 70s. There was a push for funding that came up on a national level that really helped develop a lot of bilingual resources and publications that serve as a foundation and kind of starting off point for getting set orthographies, the writing system, developing the tools. But what has continued that work is really the tribes and tribal organization, their commitment to carry out language work. There are some issues that partner really well. I think you had a good presentation from the Regents on their level that can show what happens in a school district and a school and a parent community and the superintendent all work together. However, I think that example really shows, and the data will show the report of language work that we've done in the state, is that the driver for it has been the tribes and the indigenous people and the parents and families who have come down to the grandmothers. We maybe have kept our languages alive as the moving force. It's not that men haven't been involved, it's just that women, especially our teenagers, our grandmothers, were the ones who have been doing the lion's share of the work. And so what the court looks like has been weaving together over a period of time, for decades, some state funding, more federal funding, trying to have a more robust relationship. relationship with their organ for funding, and then a lot of volunteer work. I think you've, I believe this committee has heard from Lisa Wade and her work at Young Dog School. And I think they have an example of where Aunt Katie, he's the painter there who started the school because she saw the pipeline for young men going to prison was a cycle that was repeating. And she had done work in the prison system with that young man. And then they come out, and they were living for the on the outside. And so she decided to take up stream a little bit in the proverbial sense and start with the youth when they were younger. And this is all out of pocket. Started a school in a small cabin to work with the youth. And that's where the young girl school has transformed and grown since then. I think that's an example of the model of how determined, especially our matrilineal, our matriarchs, are to keep this alive and support for that kind of work is really what makes the transformation and what makes it last.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Zukoski. Go ahead, Mr. Isaac. That was a great discussion, and I'm trying to think if we have her for this way of that particular program. I'm thinking about it. We heard from our committees on other issues, but not necessarily right here, so sorry,
thank you for the fair. It might have been said education, sorry, but sometimes you get excited about who's not at which.
Understood.
All right, so we're going to go to slide 6. This is the dynamic amount of sounds slide or handout. And you might hear that same Danina and Danina. That's part of that. Vowels are a way that dialect is really expressed. So there are 7 distinct ways that the word Danina or Danina or Danina has been recorded and widely recognized by first language speakers to be said. So if you're in Anchorage and you hear someone say, the Danina Convention Center or the Danina Convention Center or the Danina Convention Center, it's all the same word. It's not the comment wrong. It's the way that someone's grandmother said that word. And that's the way that individual formed the word. That's one of the pieces that I often think are into immigration. So I'm not going to read through every single letter name on this page. I want to our letters do have titles between the letters. And I have a resource tool that is going to hold up to the camera, but you also have the handout. This is a baby workbook. So this is the letter L, and the Danina word is F. And so it's, and L looks like a slight apostrophe. And L's, you can't, the L stop. You can't stop there at the beginning of the word. And so this L in the moment you would see at the end of one of the little word. So that's an example of most of the sounds that have been in this handout are word initial sounds, but some of them just can't be word initial sounds. And that's one of the differences between our business languages and English is that not every letter connects you at the front of a word or an initial. The next letter that's different is TH. TH, and that's the letter CHO. That's, it looks like a CH, that's CHO. And the one right next to it is CHO. And the better word for that is CHO, which is a front, so it's the CHO. And then our next non-English letter name is the letter P, which is Dana. And then we have the letter N, or Dana, which is Nidi, which means moose. And then the letter Z, and our key word for that is Z. If we jump down to the G's, we have what looks like a double G, and we say Ka. And then we have the next letter is the. That's a TH that we call it that the. And then we have a T below. That's not the H, sorry, there's a hat in H. It's an H that looks like it has a little hat on top of it, which is what we call the hat in H. And then our next non English letter is the letter Bard L. Bard L. And the example of that is T, which means glacier or ice. example, you know, the letter Q at the bottom of that, so that's twice that's the Q bottom. And then the next letter, go down to the next section, is the letter sun. And that sun is a word for chart. And then if you go up to T sections, there's quite a few T's. We have table, and then we have tool. And then we have tool row. And then if we go left, one of the T's that we have to do is set and set low. And then we have two more non-English letters. And that's where your added line is like the added page where it has a little carrot or a hat on top of it. And that makes the sound C. It also, it probably has always done a word final, you know, that letter in different parts of the word. And it's only really commonly used in one alphabet. And then we have the letter V. And so that's our alphabet. And some of the non-English letters. You also notice that we don't have any letters in the English alphabet. Like I said before, doing a little bit of English instruction with the English alphabet song is part of how we bridge that gap. And pause there if there's any questions before I go to the next grand kind of transition. So those are all of the word of the mouth that I've heard that we can have multiple slides, we can do flashcards with that. The next piece that I wanted to show is this is where the cultural teaching I'm about to dive into is more called lexicological teaching. It's based on a traditional drama story. It's a very short story. I'm going to read it in English, and it's called When the Animals Divided into Pairs. And it's in the beginning, they say the animals divided into pairs. They would talk together, and they would take one another as partners. They said, you will be my friend. And they said, the vines will be our food. And Cottonwood and Spruce had no partners. Spruce said to Cottonwood, they are both tall. We should be partners. But Cottonwood said, well, that will just remain by myself. And none of the animals took the dog. And Spruce was all covered with sores and filled with pus. This is why no one took it. And Spruce said, this is why I will be useful to campfire people. They will use my friendship to get food poisoning. And the dog said, I too will go with the campfire people. I will tell them about where you are staying. And then the animals said, they did the song. So they talked to you. The dog will tell you anything. Talk to you. He will tell you anything. But then you can have this creeping song for good luck. So in our stories, when the animals and plants are talking about us as people, we're called the campfire people. That's the animal's name. Our story had the spruce tree, it had the cottonwood tree, and it had the dog. So that the dog in Indiana, we have human pronouns and we have non-human pronouns. Dogs are termed, combined with humans when we talk about them. And the story helps show why dogs are so important. They are wrapped in with our human pronoun description. And then the other piece that it shows is that partnerships are really important. And our words are really made up of partner pieces of language. And the spruce tree is the most helpful plant, most helpful tree to our people. And I'm going to switch to so that's, if you look at the spruce tree, this is in Grand Teacher Road. You see the different parts of the tree. We have our rings. You look here, that dark line in the middle, that's called the core or pith of the tree. When the tree first started growing and had all that movement, that was the core of the tree. Once it's done that, each year it produces a new ring. And that comes from the cambium layer. And then we have bark, and there's pitch. The other thing that we often don't see on the surface is spruce roots. So, and they're very, very useful, like a little tiny person in basket. You can see that spruce roots, that's this part here, are what we start with. So even things we can't see from the spruce tree help us. And it works in partnership with the birch tree and the willow tree to make very useful and helpful things for our legislative work to work against it. The other parts of this perpetuity have branches. If you think about a branch, it has needles with it. So we can talk about like individual pieces of the first tree, like here's the branch part with no needles on it. And that's different than a spruce branch that has needles attached. We also have just arrow spruce needles. So we can talk about all of those individual parts of the spruce tree. But if I hold this up, is this a spruce tree? No, this is a spruce bark. But we have everything I did. It's a piece of the tree, but it's not a whole tree all by itself. Also, if we turn this piece over, we can see that there's a beetle, spruce bark beetle, that's dominating and eating all that area. And the lesson thing for this analogy, for this teaching, is the story I talked about spruce being medicine. So I have all different pieces. You can see that this is methodical, but this is sticky pitch, and this is older, drier pitch. Pitch is what the tree uses as medicine. Trees can't pull up the roots around and from the forest and pop back down and then get medicine from a sewer and then walk back home. So what trees have to do is they have to make their own medicine and bring it to themselves because they can't go and get it. And spruce pitch is kind of like our language for our people. The rattle is the medicine that helps make us whole and make us well. So that's the energy of the lesson each week on every part of the spruce tree. But the main thing that I want to cover, if you go to the Instagram slide 7, is there are, you can see the color coded images on slide 7. So at the top where there's a stem, every tree, in order to be a tree, which you have to have. I showed all the different parts, but I didn't hold up a spruce tree in front of me. I held a piece of wood, I held a pitch. So the components of a whole tree are the stem. That's the picture with the white background. The bark, that's the green picture. The red picture has that pith or that core that I showed at the middle of the logo. There's the branches. The branches have needles. That's the branch part of it. So that's two pieces that are intrinsically connected. They both have individual functions, but they kind of form one unit, which is one part of the tree. And then there's the canopy layer on the outside. And the blue picture on the bottom is like those tree rings. And those serve as the definitions for the different parts of each and the lack of cognitive function. So if we have not a book, that means what happened. That will put on a poll, that's the kind of question for how many people are involved. We have not a poll to tell oak, which is who did it. Not oak and oak, which is how that may happen, that's the condition to that point. Then we have the thought of oak and oak. That's the same question repeated, because those are the two, the pink and the red, and the salmon color and the red color are both parts where water has flown through the tree. And then we have that, and then you fill in the blank with whatever verb, and that's cool what had happened to them. And so these are our question works. Every single one of the blue questions have to be answered for every single verb phrase. But the other five questions, every single united verb or sentence has to answer those five questions. And so if we go to slide 8, that's the English translation for those pieces. And I'm going to pause there for any questions. The next is slide 9. It's a handout that you can now see a spruce tree drawn. And what I would do is I would do this with flashcards. And so I would ask in English, what happened? And I have the same question then again. I have it in plain writing. And I go, Una Kadyok. And Nana, I would say, on this sheet, Kadyok, which in English means cry, so I have the students write cry down underneath their little chart on the top, and then you see it has the stem or the pillar, and you would write cry on the stem. And then I would ask the next question, how many people are involved? Which is the question, and arrow and a draw on the bark of the tree. I have the students follow them. And then I ask the next question, oak, and that's who did it. And on our little table up top, there's the moving S. That is being the English S means I. So I have the student write I, the English word for I under S. And then we have our last question, which is how and when did it happen? Which is, and that's quote, continual. And that has the student wrong. And so what I have the students do is they write zeros along the branches of the tree, like they're drawing needles onto that blank bare branch on the right. And so, you get at this first tree, it looks like this. It has diagram. And then you build the tree from the base up, from the roots and from the stem up, and now we read it from the top of the tree down. So it's this shadow, which means diagram. So that's a way of showing and tracking the information for one of the languages, the one that's very difficult to remember. And so if we go to the next page, it's my 10,
as of the section, I noticed you first. It seemed that you proceeded from the right side of that diagram towards the left, starting with the stem and the trunk. Question, is there a bit? What's the rationale there? Or is it that I build the word with a sense?
Welcome to the end of the great question. So, we build our words from our paper resources from the right to the left. And if we think about building a tree from the top up, is that same piece where we start with our stem? It's the thing that everything is built off of. So we start there, and then we go left. Because that's the way that the domain languages do heavy prefixing. And that's one of the differences between the non-domain languages in Alaska, that there's more plus places or suffixation, where domain languages do a lot more prefixation. And then when you read the language, you say it from left to right. And that's just the way that the language functions and the way of tracking the information. Because everything's based off of that stem. You can't have a branch on that there's nothing to attach to.
Except that it's hard to catch. Thank you.
Proceed the question. Okay, alright. So, we'll proceed. This is Torres again. That just shows the stem piece of information. Is that the next? And then there's the classifier. There's not a direct English equivalent to the term classifier. This is also described as dangerous. After the other, after my first teaching, I know the students, ask me if your mother told you I had to be there in a moment. The first thing he says, half hour, half a flower, you have to come in. The next one down is going to be your subject pronouns. So this is one of the things that the domain does that many other languages in the world don't do, is we write that word pronoun for the word that can be in our words. And you can see F means the plural, both the letter N and the letter I, both of those have the English translation for you. So we have two more things that mean you. And then we have the morpheme S, which means I. And I'm sorry, I went just from right to left. So those are our inner subject pronouns. And if we think about things that are close to the inside, those are things that are closest to the speech situation. If we go to the next slide, this is the domain imperfective. So one of the things that makes domain languages so difficult for other people in the world to learn is that they're very descriptive, which many languages are very descriptive. But the way that we describe time is different than in other languages. So you can see we have imperfective, and that's a lighter blue, soft color, and then we have perfective, which is yellow. Domain only has one tense, which is the danger tense. We do otherwise we have imperfective, perfective, and objective. And so that's one of the differences that we have spent a lot of time with students learning is about time. So imperfective would be described as things that have started, but have not stopped. They're ongoing, and then perfected things are things that have started and have completed. And then future things are things that were intended to happen but haven't happened yet. And opposite things are a desire for that verb to take place, which I don't have on the sheet. Those are the four modes that we have in the denier. So only one of them is the equivalent tense in English. I'm just showing a couple of the different prefix options. There are many prefixes, but this is the top prefix in the bottom of this page, which refers to talking or speech. So this is a prefix that means the reference is speaking or speech. And if you think about its first frame, when you have the person burning it crackles really loudly, and that's that connection to like what part of the verb is crackling while the reference is speaking is the top. That appears there.
Two more concepts. Common second identifier. Note that representative content is described in the campus model. When we're doing a lesson in the IML language, or at least major primary interrelated text, I'm going to take that for this lesson.
Thank you. The next slide has the cause of why, which means connected with, or with a wish or intent for the endeavor to take place. So, for example, if you go to the store and you buy something, you're intending by giving them money that they're going to give you something in return. That's the kind of example. Or if you call somebody, you're hoping they'll answer. You intend for them to answer, but you don't control them. I call them a phone, you can deny the phone call. Or if I didn't call loudly enough and you hear me, you don't have to respond. There's a kind of a vocal piece about calling or buying or questioning. And if we think about it, we've never been forced to make a ring bit from the first trace and have that whistling movement sound. And that's what I think about the college of I, is that it's the, you're projecting your voice and you're making things move and you have to respond to it. And so that's the trace kind of dancing in the wind and whistling in the wind. The other piece is the outer subject of pronouns. And these, if you think back to our first analogy, the community where it has the growth rings, where we have the growth rings, and it's hard to look at this time, so we have a zero. The zero is actually making you have. So zeros are placeholders. There's something kind of algebraic about putting verbs together, and it's helpful to not lose the verb. But I put that piece in to answer that question. And so that's the she-he-it. So in the land, there, we don't have sex-based gender pronouns. It's girl, but she's that pronoun she needed. There's no difference between sex. He walked, it walked, or he walked. We don't even make the sound for that morpheme. We then have connection to cha, which means in English be, and then we have ta, which means something, and then ta, which is the or some object entity. And you can see how there's little parentheses with little e's in there. Sometimes those e's are there, and sometimes there's not. They're helper words. So if you think that sometimes cats are you need an extra set of hands, that's that bell, is an extra set of hands to help you. And sometimes you don't need it, and so you're not going to ask for it. And that's a little bit about that. And then we have our object pronouns, that's blue, and that's the tree ring part of the tree. We have ta, which means something. We have pay, which can be the subject and the object at the same time. That's why I have that slash words blue and pink. If you think about they verb them, which means like, is it they hit them? There would only be one pronoun that you use in you. They have both the subject and the object simultaneously. So in English, we don't do that. We express both pronouns in the end, and we need one pronoun for meaning both object and subject. And then we have, which means me, and then ta, which means them. There are more pronouns than that, but it's just a sampling. If you go to the next page, 13, this is called the Dynamorphology Verb Index. And you can see on the top chart, it has all the different colors. Each one of these prefix positions corresponds to a paragraph's first tree. So, I just showed you the different images. There's other images, like there's the Z image, that's a prefix that specifically means to have face. So think about how important Zach is our cultures. The way that we kind of use these materials is a metaphor from the back. Where you have fish. And so these are flashcards that students can use. So that's one of the thematic prefixes that's kind of origin for. And there's another one, new. And this is a little spruce tree that's fallen over and the bugs and the mushrooms are eating it and recycling it. And that's iterative, meaning cyclical. Things that happen in cycles. So trees grow up, they fall down, they get eaten, they burn, return back to the earth, and then new trees grow from them. It's a cycle, it's an iterative cycle. Below that one, there's a black and white image, and that shows each one of those prefix positions with the morphemes. Morphemes are like elements of your table, the smallest, small units to make up an entire speech meaning. You can see that this chart shows the different morphemes that can exist in those categories. And so you might see, if you're looking at it now, it's a little bit fuzzy, but if you see that there's the front FTH appears in the moment position, if there's a thematic position, and it appears in a couple of places throughout. And so in one spot, it could mean perspective, meaning the action has come to complete. However, in a different spot, it could mean plot, which means you can work. And so the color coding and the images really help kind of track that information. This part of the complexity of why our language is a little bit difficult to learn because you can't just pull through an image where you have to pay attention to which slot you're in because, like neighbors, if you have a loud neighbor that's blaring the music, that you have a different relationship with that neighbor than possibly the neighbor that brings you cookies when you first moved in. It's a neighbor's effect. It's an effect like her bowels and confidence in their picture. And we go to slide 14, which is our last slide in this presentation. And this is diagram verbs. And so this is a tool where I use this as a teacher doing and you can do flashcards with it. So I have that in red at the top, plus the tone, which means you plural radio. So when I was working with a bunch of 3-year-olds and it's time to pick up the first time from head to heart, let's say, I would say Zachtown, tactical Zachtown, which means everybody, you all, lay down. And so if we, and this is, this kind of shows it up. So if we have our STEM, it's going to be the same with the flashcards. So we have our STEM for time. And we have something over, we have our English, which is imperfective, single animal lagging in time. So that's what this morpheme means. And that's what the STEM of our first thing. And then what we need next is our bark. And I would ask the question, and that's what we're trying to pull. And it would be zero, and that's how many people are involved, and there were not the people in this story. And then I would go to the next flashcard, and we have F, which is our question, bird, oak, elk. And that means you plural. And we have one last piece. We have our Z, and that means imperfective, which means you're supposed to start laying down, but I'm not telling you to stop laying down. So lay down and then you'll stop. And that's the letter Z with that blue background. And what I do when I'm teaching this with the students is I'll hold up the question, and then I'll superimpose the flashcard over it. So you're learning, like, here's the question, what's the answer? And that's a way of the flashcards with the students. This one was for, we did the example for you in plural lay down. If I wanted to say, I lay down, I would change out this morpheme, this flashcard, for fish. And we could build the word that way. Because these things go in the same tone in our chart. So this means I, this means you. So that's why we use the flashcards. It helps with spelling, it helps with speaking, and learning the different phonemes and morphemes and letter names. The next step is Colcott, which is T87. So you can see that Simon is falling off the side, it's now all by itself. And if by mind change the verb, this is the one half in front of you is cut with the vowel at the end, which means eat object. If I want to change it to mean I am eating salmon, I would have to change it to a different stem, which would be this stem here, which is a different color. And so we can exchange our stems that way. And that's how we use the first one to find the permanent. And then the last one we have cheetah relationships, which means cheetah sensitivity. And this one is a good example for verbs. So our verbs are very specific and descriptive. So cheetah means to sip something, which is different than drinking. Where our drinking verb is, it's the verb is new. But if you don't put the word water in front of it, then it's an unsensitive drinking alcohol. So for the drinking verb, in fact, it's really important to put the button drinking in front of it, because that relates to the verb. And for sipping, it's understood that it's hot. So sipping a cold, iced coffee sipping is different than hot coffee sipping. And you have to describe it that way in the verb structure. So that's the demonstration that I have for you all today. I thank you very much for allowing me to share this. And like I said earlier in the presentation, there are other language groups that are doing similar kinds of work that could do a demonstration for their language. The goal for me today was to show a Dani Inu example. And in wrap up to that presentation, I want to do one more thing with you that involves teaching tools. I started talking about this in a cultural lesson, and we looked at different parts of games and how might that build skills for other parts of education. So what I have in front of you here, does anyone recognize this? This is called H2O. There are oxygen in the middle, we have our hydrogens, and we have our electron clouds. This is a water molecule. I have this molecule, which is different. It's a methane molecule, which is natural gas. You can see how both the hydrogens, it both has hydrogens. It's made up of individual small parts that have relationships to each other. The electron clouds have a different relationship than the straight bonds to the hydrogen do, and vice versa for the carbon has that as well. And when these two things reduce, when they're combined, into something totally different. So now, our carbon, which is the red one, and our oxygen, the blue one, now look like this. We're going to pretend that the triple bond is null. And then we get these leftover hydrogens. And they've now transformed. Even though they're the same building blocks, they've transformed into something else. And so, the reason I'm showing this is that by teaching early on something cultural that looks at the world that describes it, which is far off from your language, so it's very descriptive, it can take something like organic chemistry and help scaffold the skill sets that you need on learning about organic chemistry. I can do the same thing with calculus, but I find chemistry more fun, and so I have a modeling kit that I brought with me with today. Calculus isn't quite as fun for me to share it, since I hold it in my hands. I just want to show that connection between these things that we're doing question words, that are looking at colors, looking at paying attention to parts of plants in the natural world. Those same principles apply to what I did in my little demonstration called class. And so this doing cultural skills is not somehow lesser or doesn't meet the required Western education. It's really based on things like inquiry, paying attention, learning to listen. Those are pieces that transcend all kinds of every environment. So I just wanted to do that last demonstration that you know, like, how does language learning help you learn with your right or how are current sciences? That's an example about what we did today. Helps pay attention to our things that we've done here. So I'm going to pause there and see if there are any questions. And I can
That was wonderful. I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm going to go back a little bit.
electricity. This has been largely done at the local level. The state funding, specifically in our case, the grant funding for something like this, systematically speak to like the last 4 years of education funding. But there are what it requires, and I said at the beginning, now there are estimates to grant the government rightly funding this, is because there has to be a connection between a tribe and a school district that might be receiving the state funding. And that's the implication being yes, that does happen occasionally. In order to come together and work on something like this. I think that the result that you see more from that or something like this, where you have like a baby board book or a publication like something like this that's a smaller publication, those are examples of how state donors might flow to a district and then a district might seek to partner with a tribe to produce that resource. The challenge that becomes on the ground to make something like this take place is that the tribes aren't necessarily in a position without a mechanism like contracting to direct that funding to support language in this kind of development. I caveat that there are some districts who have leadership either via the school or the community demanding it to take place and superintendents to develop government framework. For example, Secretary Walker has spoken about. That's an example of how that has been possible, but only possible because you have all of those pieces aligned, and there was a large enough pool of workers to be able to carry out that work. And so, the impact learning framework is one of those legendary flagship models that, again, was advocated for so strongly by the community to require a school board to invest in that, the state dollars that do come to the local school boards, and have a superintendent be able to implement it. However, if one of those pieces comes out of alignment, then it fails. And that's the part that I would say the track expressed concern about our frustration with how it's messing with them is that the projects that kind of start at school level for briefly, and then get corrected, it's hard to get that cumulative building to produce systematic curriculum that address the different types of standards that we expect or are familiar with our English language or our Western sciences or whatever those topics are. So, I hope to answer your question, minimal direct state funding to this kind of work. There are state dollars that do support this work, but in order for it to happen, that has to be partnership between the district, because that's the mainly funded mechanism.
And a follow-up question. Thank you, Andrea. I think you already answered that. This is slightly illuminating and does answer your question. I'm curious to better understand at the joint session or the joint committee to hear from the State Board of Education last week, I posed a question about culturally relevant and culturally based learning opportunities in the classroom. Similar a bit to your response this morning, but absent the context, there was the reference back to the opportunity for tribal contracting. The question that I posed to the State Board, I want to pose a little bit again today. Because while I appreciate the promise that tribal contracting and education can offer to schools, I am a bit concerned about repeating a separate but equal doctrine in Alaskan schools. And certainly there are students, Alaskan native students, who come from bilingual homes that learn and live and go to school in urban environments like Anchorage and Burbank, Centennial, where maybe that culturally based, place-based education begin to look a little bit different and be integrated a bit differently into a school classroom environment. So I'm curious to hear how expansive the conversations have been with MPAID and potentially from the State Board of Ed that you might be aware of to advance dialogue around culture-based education and how that contributes to energy efficiency and literacy in environments that are not necessarily within a carbon compacted space or network.
Through the chair, because it was fascinating, I appreciate that question. I think that helps. It helps in two parts. One, contracting and strikes as far as an education, as then we're looking at pilot, and pilot being small. So if we're looking at a small slice of something, there's still the other large portion that needs to be addressed. So I appreciate the question being made to that. The different strategies, I would start the state program, when I get kind of work my way down, because I had to be organizing the talks in that way. The Varian committees that presented as a joint hearing recently, the rating committee and the tribal compacting committee and the teacher committee, they're starting to have some pretty strong overlap in what it looks like. So what is demonstrated to you isn't necessarily something that you've done in a regular or standard teacher prep program. It's something that in addition to getting a PhD or a second graduate session master's program really equips them to be able to develop these tools. So opening up and addressing additional teacher pathways that are rooted in cultural or indigenous practices and pedagogy is a really critical way to adjust the systemic with your product system systemic approach. So that the teachers are a big part of it. But I think part of that also teachers oftentimes talk as teachers and principals, which working by superintendents is kind of that flow and that track. So having programs in both teacher prep programs and administrative preparation programs that are rooted in this is a really important piece. And so we've been having conversations at the department with the university. I've been meeting with the Alaska Native Studies Council, which is APU, LSI, and UA system, Indigenous faculty, to talk about what it looks like, because it's not a university. We don't offer programs to confer credit for degrees. But we do have that connection to the university to describe what we're seeing as the need for our students. So we have been very recently, in the last couple months, having regular conversations and meetings with the Alaska Native Studies Council, also inviting the tribes and organizations that have programs like the Alaska Heritage Institute has a really awesome cultural teacher program that had a rating covering weekend programs. So I invite folks from there and in this Kutupat, which is an Inupiaq language learning group. So it's kind of grassroots up from what is the university doing, what are the tribes, what are the language workers in the world doing to meet that educator need. In those conversations, we're also hearing what are the curriculums that are in need, what are the obstacles, and then we're starting to see in the department, and we can heard up there, right here as well, that the meeting symposium is taking place. We're carving out time specifically there as well. We'll be talking about the cultural components, teaching through culture, both as kind of a here are the skills that are needed to be done, but then how do you implement something like that? So that's kind of a deep support for educators coming in from our current system. And also starting to have regularly occurring meetings internally to address how do we implement systematize these through the cultural opportunities with existing funding. But make it part of the norm, the state norm. And so that's a very recent piece. The linguistic, the need for this kind of education has been being brought to the table repeatedly. And I would say that we are listening to that indeed, and we are doing that initial groundwork to build up the systemic approach for how we address this. I don't put ourselves specific examples. I don't know if that's it, but I'm going to pause there because I missed something, please.
Follow up for presenters. Thank you so much. That certainly helps answer the question, and I think gets to sort of the concern that I had in terms of lumping the lion's share of culture-based learning into a concept like tribal contract administration, because certainly culture does not exist in a classroom environment separate from the students, whether it's in a typical public classroom environment or in a rural area. And so that definitely helps answer that question. I'm interested if you have and you touched on this a bit. I'm interested in better understanding the intersection between the state's desire to focus on reading and the opportunity to leverage language and culture based knowledge that you shared with us today, understanding that, as you mentioned, these are ongoing conversations that are happening within the department, the assessment of evaluating what are the curriculum needs, what are the obstacles that districts are facing in terms of considering needs for Dean's perspective of how does Dean help to implement and systemize making culture-based education in rural residential all public schools in Alaska. Understanding that much of the work is continuing, but the legislature has been also considering in real time around that learning that's happening at the department and board level, how to focus on improving reading in Alaska. So I'm hoping that you might be able to identify for us a bit more what could it look like in terms of leveraging the language and culture-based knowledge that you've shared with us today and this broader desire to focus on reading, understanding that travel protecting can't be the answer for all of those questions.
I think that the other document that I provided for the committee and to write the committee helps kind of get the pulse, the historical context about me. And so I'm not going to go through the whole thing because I have the previous demonstration, but I'm going to touch on some components of that I think may help answer the question that you asked. So if you look at the historical trauma that Alaska Native peoples have gone through and continue to experience, much of that is tied to Warden School era trauma that was during what is known in federal law as the Federal Termination Policy era. And reading and English learning was part of that fabric. And so a lot of communities were in language reverse, have a very adverse experience, a reaction to the topic of reading. So part of the work that there has to be done is to provide a space for Indigenous people, for Alaska Native Language workers, to bring Indigenous reading, Alaska Native Language reading, forward in a way that helps the language and promotes it, which is different than the historical way that English was taught, which was through torture. So the education system was used to eradicate languages. It can also help bring them back. But the way that that's done has to be done in with Indigenous people leading our work. And that's a critical piece. And what that looks like in the public, how does this happen functionally? There has to be dedicated space for the language workers to come together. So like what I've just shown you here, I've shown other groups that I've worked with. They've taken different pieces and they said, I can't teach that way, but that something else that you did spark this, I don't want in that direction with it. So coming together where there's problem solving that's happening in pockets around the state. But if I solve one piece and you solve one piece and they solve one piece, I haven't solved those two pieces and they come together and they show how that got solved. Now we can solve all three problems really quickly instead of having to independently address them. And so I think that's the other piece that we've seen over the comments and bilingual publications. That was part of the synergy that was happening when it was a flourishing moment. And so that's part of how does that happen? That's part of how it happens. And that's why I have the reading symposium, carving out that space as a way to show people. I think that's the other piece, and again, I really appreciate being able to demonstrate today. I can talk in linguistic theory and morphology and all these pieces today until you're here for reading, but I can also just show you it so that you could see it and then start to think, oh, how did I learn English this way? And so that's part of it. Back to the touchstone, or those five components, the type of reading, there's also a piece that's really important, which is morphology. It's a piece that we've talked about that's critical for Western languages, and that cultural piece. So that's part of how it's related. And then kind of closing to answer that question, I think the other piece that's creating a different level of understanding, that learning as native language speakers and indigenous people, English language learning is not the same as bilingual learning. So English language learning, historically, again, the federal policy has been to get someone non-English speaker to speak exclusively English from a policy standpoint. Our goal, indeed, is not to help all the kids who are speaking only English. We want them to be able to read in English. We want them to be able to speak English. But we also want them to have their heritage language, whether that's Nupak or whether that's Samoan. Whatever it is, that looks like a bilingual or a multilingual approach as opposed to a monolingual approach. And so that's part of the work that takes to kind of transform the system, is transitioning away from monolingualism into multilingualism. I'll pause there.
Thank you, Dr. Chair, for the opportunity to Chinese, this committee might consider with respect to ensuring that as the state pursues strategies around reading proficiency for Alaskan children, how we can provide the space to bring Alaskan language reading into the education system and to transition away from what outdated federal policy of English language. Only and looking towards multi linguals, and I'd be interested in hearing maybe the thoughts that we went to on in terms of our consideration of statutory language to protect the work and intention and spirit of what you've shared with us today.
Thank you for the question. Chair, I represent the Society of Generalizing Learning Education. There are two ways that I'd answer it. One is bringing the tribal voice to the table, because I think that that is where the solutions lie. The other part of the answer is how does D function, how does D education function statutorily? There are several layers. There's a state work level, there's a department level, there's local school work level, and then there's the classroom. And so having dedicated space for Alaskan Native language work in each level of those systems, that's really what it takes to have something like this do a shift and bring in that kind of wisdom and expertise to those layers of government and education. Is from an operational side, like how statutes function, those are the statutory frameworks for how education is delivered. And then from the tribal side of like how we do this, that's where the answer lies. And so it has to be done together in order for it to be success. And if it kind of comes back, if you drop off one of those three pieces, you don't have the support you need to actually affect the entire education system because the state, local, and classroom are the key to the education system. And so any type of policy that's trying to statewide has to answer those three questions of how is it on a state level, how is it on a local government level, how is it in the classroom. Those are the questions that I think about from our department questions. And then for this specific topic, the tribal voice has to be brought to that work as a full-fledged partner, because the answers again they don't rely on from the tribes and the native language working community.
Thank you, Representative Zukowski. I just want to make a comment that just like you've shown us how to build a word in Tanzania, and all three parts have to be present. Questions have to be answered with answering that. That was very strategic. I'll have Representative Hopkins as the next question, followed by Representative Story.
Thank you, Madam. I think we're going to ask how we create that space for this work to happen.
do well, you bring people together. It's something that I can enjoy from at the top level of kids, and you can have something that could possibly help you in doing that. Or do you know the thing is not to help? Or two, the whole thing is not to help. Policy decisions and things, statutory changes. So, I just want to ask specifically about that.
Chair Representative Hopkins to Isaac Department of Education. That kind of dedicated space, whether it's at a body like that, whether it's a consortium, if you look at the Indian Health Service AHS contracting model, there's the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium that kind of functions like that for the health field. That same level of either advocacy or expertise to inform assistance is something that has been shown to be successful with tribes we're familiar with. It's one of the when we had the tribal engagement field meetings before COVID that was brought up as one of the pieces the tribes have been asking for. If we look at the Alaska Native Language Policy Advisory Council report, that's something else that's also been echoed as a way to address it. So having some type of body of dedicated workers to address these types of issues is really what it takes to make the work happen. And so, that's how I would say that kind of the answer, if you look at what's being recommended from our tribal voices, from our language experts, that those two things are aligning. And so, that's just kind of bringing some of those voices to the table.
Well, that brings me to
The Alaska Native Language Policy or Preservation Advisory Council, the NOPAC, every 2 years puts together a new report to the legislature. And I can follow up with the committee to make sure you have that report. And it outlines the recommendations that group has part of the state system for helping language work. And Dr. Tony Mitchell touched on his presentation. As well, that's part of what he was referencing, not towards his mouth, but he also has his expertise in his bringing base policy for some of that report information to the committee as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Representative Story. Madam Chair, I have not been here, so I thank you for being your person today. Would you explain and help us learn? Science and reading. So it's going to come through my head.
because I don't think our schools and will allow the space because we do have some medical schools in the state. And so anyway, if you could help me understand how this could all work together and be supportive.
Such a story, you know, as a part of condition. I think that the way that you described the situation, and you know, just laying out kind of the verbal layout, is the answer lies in there. So the assessment pieces that are being developed, there's a need for a multilingual assessment. So if you were to ask me, some of the questions I frequently get is, what does it look like to read a third grade in an indigenous language? The skill sets that I just showed today for learning the orthography, that happens very quickly. I touched a little bit on this on the text that came out. The orthography gives up very quickly. The morphology, which helps to bring the comprehension and fluency pieces, take longer to get to, because it's very difficult to be reversed and lost in native language. And so what a reading level has, and the way the word function is totally different. And so I think about those five questions in the email. There's only two questions in English we have to answer. Who did it? And what did they do? And you have those five questions. So that's part of the needing to take a hard look at those levels to develop bilingual reading level standards. And not standards, and these were standards that have turned around for some people over the years to hear and say, no, not making it. I think that's part of the way of addressing the way that standards are developed, is that it's touching on phonemic awareness, phonics, those kinds of things. But it's not saying that it has to be done in English. The standards for indigenous language or bilingual learning don't necessarily exist as a prepackaged something that you can just buy off the shelf. They have to be made. And so that's part of the issue right now with creating kind of different entry points for answering your question. For English reading, we kind of already have the answer and have the conversation here. The rest of the language that has been suppressed for so long, that the entrance point for the solution is a different starting point. And so it's identifying what that starting point is, and then resourcing it so that we can get an equal, same level of what we're looking at. And again, those questions, those pieces of what third grade reading looks like in an English-only group or a multilingual might be different, what looks like on paper as levels, but you need to be able to compare them to where this proficiency is demonstrated here, it's in place with third grade reading level, this proficiency is developed here, that equates to a third grade reading level. And I think that's part of the way that you phrase the question and when you outline the steps that it takes to do it.
So you're saying really two assessments need to be developed depending upon whether you have it or whether you are in the teaching environment that you have. So I see mostly one assessment tool.
To your story, the Jurassic form of education. I would say that the state assessment tool, it's like a statewide, being made resources made available. There's a couple ways to carve out that native language space because the language has varying levels of culturally based less native language terminology throughout it. So if there is a single assessment that's being offered as a tool available for districts to use if they choose, but as part of that assessment tool, there's a bilingual component. And so that's a way of creating carving out this space of first. A current language is just adding that space. The other way is to
to break it up to where it's like there is an English proficiency assessment and there is a bilingual proficiency assessment. That bilingual tool, and this is part of what we have a conversation around the concept of full bilingual literacy for education, where it's like, well, that is presented to my field, how does that work out, how does that work in an EPS, how does it work in any other languages? So that assessment framework has to be covering skills, not saying you need to learn the word being club in order to pass your assessment. It has to be analyzing skills and defining what those skills are. And that's the way that one task can do that, but also having that dedicated carve-out space for both, I think, is very helpful, just because the linguistic mechanics, you're looking for different proficiencies in your linguistic mechanics that are shared within a lot of indigenous languages or non-English languages that we don't have in common in English, because English is a combination of two different languages.
But first, I need to make an observation because what you're pointing to that for me, Joel, is, for example, Superintendent Barber of the North Missouri Board School District told us the difficulty they had in developing their board language curriculum because it didn't exist and they couldn't afford to hire more than one curriculum specialist and they needed grants to do the rest of it. And in terms of proficiency, but Ida Prum, Litnovic, and Bethel, they told us that maybe their kids were not at grade level by grade three the way we were expecting kids to be in English. But by sixth grade, they were doing really well, and by high school graduation, also did really well. So the expectations somehow are. Need to be different because of the amount of language acquisition that's happening. And for me, it's understanding the different levels of language development and the orthography of all the different languages that are spoken in Alaska. They all seem to be at different levels of development. Therefore, it's hard to apply one standard to each language. These are just random observations that I'm making. You're trying to pull together and you can do that, so I appreciate that. Representative Sobeski.
So Isaac told her story that I touched on an issue that is a smart concern of mine with respect to historic trauma that you've referenced in your white paper with respect to federal English language policy typically residing in the space of English-only proficiency absent significant cultural diversity that we see in Alaska and the importance around heritage languages that we've been talking about today. And with respect to the question about assessment and what proficiency assessment looks like in terms of ensuring, because it sounds through dialogue with you today as though lead is still in a position of trying to understand how to systemize and help implement these efforts, would it be your assessment that having a dedicated body or consortium would be fundamental to the development of an existing tool that we could expect to provide better validity in terms of a student's proficiency and where the State Department led to pursue developing those tools singularly or absent that dedicated body? And then the second question. I'm interested in, actually, I'll just start there.
Thank you for posing for that question. Yeah, it helps. So, the dedicated body piece, I think that
meeting together with the customer that we worked with the meeting previously, the comments that I received from the tribal and language group for engagement has been there are the 21 additional languages in Alaska, one of them being English, the other 20 being indigenous, that in order to make sure that there's space for the needs being met from an educational standpoint, for the we're having a conversation about the context. There's the 20 Alaska Native languages. There's also other indigenous languages and non-English languages of students in our state. And so we have the challenge of Alaska Native still linguistically diverse, that how do we meet that? The having some type of dedicated body that can work with the department or as part of the department is helping to take all those considerations is really critical to having success. And I say that in the way of you look at how any department might structure attention on something. You have a focused group that works on that, whether it's accounting, whether it's HR, whether it's data configuration. Those all specialize in those things, but they work across the entire department. So I think about that as if there's a bilingual or multi-language component that can support across the department or support across the state. It helps implement anything you implemented, whether it's reading like we're talking about today, or it's cultural, teaching tools, or professional development around this, or whatever it is. There has to be something like that to provide system-wide support for an entire state. I think the other thing that we see about Alaska Native tribes, when they have, this is a success story for contacting, is tribes can serve more than just tribal members. I think that's similar to a parallel example with this. Alaska Native language focus is inclusive in nature, and so there is space for other languages, even though today I talk exclusively about Dwayne. There's still space for other Alaska Native languages to do this kind of work. There's still space for other languages, non-English languages, to have the benefit from this kind of conversation on these kinds of, like, if it's a template that's formed or standards that are developed for multilingual, whatever those things are, they benefit all languages. But by anchoring it in an Alaska Native language body, it has part of its goal being to address a multilingual approach. It benefits everybody. I'm going to answer that.
Education policies that are based out of the University of Colorado.
which offers peer-reviewed research on education policy, and they talk about the science of reading. But this was a resource provided to us by Dr. Adam Hirschberg, and talked about the importance of science of reading advocacy, having trouble with patterns such as failing to place their parents or reading in a worse historical context, overemphasizing test scores and outlier data instead of longitudinal data with great context, that science of reading policies should not be dubbed and justified against policies aimed at raising reading test scores in the short term, such as their grade retention. So as we consider issues around benchmarking proficiency, particularly in trying to foster a multilingual environment, what does that look like?
Through the chair, Ms. Cussie, I think that component about English proficiency at tertiary in a bilingual environment that regularly shows up that third grade assessment scores on English nationalized norm test is a lower score. And like I said, at sixth grade, you start to see they meet or exceed the national average and contend that downward trend. And that's been back and forth of studies that show that. And the best part of all of the demonstration today is by teaching a young student how to think about language, and learn the mechanics of reading, the science of reading principles, acquire any kind of language, acquire many kinds of systems, that learning how to do that allows you very quickly pick up a better language, especially with English being the dominant language in America, so that catching up piece happens very quickly. And so that's part of the discussion we had today is the way that I would describe it is third grade reading is an indicator, it's an important indicator. Not only will third grade reading scores don't capture the reading proficiency of a multilingual student who has been taught in an immersion program. So defining what third grade immersion reading looks like in a non-English language allows for statewide us as educators at the statewide level and policymakers to look at are the students in an immersion program reading at third grade where their third grade reading standards that are appropriate to the language grade. That doesn't necessarily address when those students take the federal requirements test in evaluating English. Other tribes and other states have worked with the federal government to either waive that third grade requirement because they're doing it through the immersion school. That's a BIA program that's currently with the feds. And it's like, our English proficiency scores aren't going to be there in third grade. Look at our sixth grade proficiency scores. That's a waiving process. I think that there's always danger in waiving something. I think there's more strength in developing a normalized process where we can look at the data in third grade, but have it properly be contextualized for what the student is learning. In this case, what does reading look like in non-English language third grade proficiency level? And that's that part of providing a tool that can do that so that policymakers, that this is the question we're starting to what their policymakers have to see, can see data that they're used to seeing that represents a standard and represents quality. We have had the question that part of what we just got a waiver for that. I don't understand why we are waiving this. So rather than going that approach, it's communicating that this is a skill set that a third grader has exhibited and yet given through an immersion program. And that's the experience I have working with kids from interim is that they give it so because they've felt that they belong to their education and they have the skill set to be able to go into any kind of environment, whether that's math, whether that's science, and pick up the science of math, pick up the science of algebra and calculus or chemistry. Because as you progress into your higher, like high school, college, and technical reading manuals, even for both kinds of classes, there's a kind of jargon that is almost like a dialect of English, where it's like, we don't speak like technical manuals for building machines.
language and said, oh, this is what these, this is how this structures, that's where the permits source and the proficiencies increase. And looking at what's called disciplinary literacy is the literacy inadequacy that uses the jargon and uses the sentence structures. So that's how we answer that question.
I really appreciate the time. If you have other questions and you'll be back and more than willing to come back. I think that the goal for today being showing rather than talking or telling you what might be possible, that the answer to how do we address third grade reading and literacy and literacy is the answer to yes, we can. And we can do that by supporting all of our languages here today. And that really is the solution. We've tried many other things over the years, but until we address our linguistic situation, we can't expect to see that change happen. I think the data that we're seeing for recommended success for students in districts who have been underserved and underperformed, that we see the solutions lie with anchoring it to our cultures, our diversity, our place, and that there is space and diversity which has a normalized part of our educational system, and that benefits all students, not just the most advanced students. So, Jermaine, you know, thank you very much for the time today.
That is not part of money. I just told you, thank you very much. And great, which was my first line work. And that's part of why I find this all so exciting and relevant. Full circle and work on native languages. In places as diverse as Alaska is very, very important and very precious to me. So thank you very much. That concludes our schedule today. Our next meeting is Friday, March 11th, 8 a.m., where we will take up House Bill 147, Rural Teacher Education Loan Program, House Bill 312, the Law of Natural Hairstyles, and Senate Bill 72. Secondary school civics education.